Hello, everybody, and welcome to another beautiful Thursday morning. You're listening to Bhavani and IE Queen on the Progressive Radio Network. And today in New York really is a beautiful day. I'm so excited to talk to all of you and then to get outside in this beautiful day. I have a great show planned for all of you today. My guest today will be John Eichard. He is a professor emeritus at the University of Missouri, and his specialty was agriculture economics. And I thought he would be the perfect person to invite on to actually talk about the current pandemic and how it's impacting our food system. And I'll tell you more about John in just a little bit when he's ready to come on. But first, I wanted to talk to you about some things going on in my life, in around the news, and some ways that you can take action. I always like to add that action piece because it's really imperative that we all become active citizens in today's world. You know, we just need to let our voices be heard because there's so much money in the lobbying world. And in order to counter that, we really need to get loud. And so that takes all of us to really let our voices be heard. Yesterday, I had another Zoom cooking class, and I'm really, really enjoying doing these so much. And I hope if you have not joined us yet that you will consider joining next week. I made a vegetable miso chowder last night, and that's one of the dishes that I've been making quite a bit during this pandemic. Anytime I feel like my immune system is at all getting a little weak or I'm feeling a little run down, miso soup is kind of like chicken broth for a vegetarian. It's just so hearty and delicious. Actually, it's way better than chicken broth. And it's just so full of so many nutrients. It's so good for your, the bacteria is so good for your gut. It's just healthy all the way around. Of course, I add wakame to it, which is a seaweed, which gives it a lot of not just umami flavor, but it fills it with so many extra nutrients of calcium and iron, and it's just loaded with vegetables, lots of ginger, lots of garlic. I did record it, so it will be posted on my website if you missed it, but that's the recipe I'm going to be sharing with you in just a little bit. But the Zoom cooking classes are really, really fun, and I welcome you all to join with that. I wanted to put a shout out to an organization called Italians Feed America. They have been helping to support the Glen Cove Food Pantry, which is Glen Cove is the school that I've been working at as the farm-to-school coordinator. And Italians Feed America have been coordinating a lot of the Italian restaurants around to get product and donate it to food pantries. And we've been happily the recipient of a lot of their product. Yesterday, I actually picked up hundreds of pounds of pasta, and I don't even know what else. They just were putting cases and cases into the back of my van. I also met with Delta Airlines, who donated a lot of products. So the Italians Feed America partnered with Delta somehow, and so Delta Airlines also was putting cases into my van, and so I will be dropping that off at the food pantry later in the week. And I'll also be picking up couple hundred pizzas on Monday for the food pantry, and every family will get a freshly made pizza, so that's also really exciting. I wanted to tell you about two things going on that you need to take some action on. One is that the Trump administration is trying to put forward a dirty water rule, which will really gut the Clean Water Act. And the Clean Water Act, as you know, protects drinking water for millions of Americans across the country. And the Environmental Protection Agency is pushing to weaken those restrictions on industrial polluters. You know, they're saying during the COVID-19, they don't have any regulators to go out and oversee it. But they're basically trying to gut the whole Clean Water Act. And so we need to call our congressional representatives to step in and block this dirty water rule. So please, I have links on my website for that. There's also a link on my website to call Senator Schumer to tell him not to put a bailout in the new federal stimulus package for fossil fuel companies. Fossil fuel companies do not need our help. They have way too much money already, and we really need to put money towards alternative energies. And we've been talking about that for a long time. Especially New York State has the Citizens Climate Protection Act, which really requires us to get off of fossil fuels. So we really need to not bail out the fossil fuel companies. Money in any federal stimulus package has to go to small businesses and alternative energy companies. So I also wanted to let you know that Elizabeth Warren has joined Cory Booker in supporting the Farm System Reform Act. And this is a bill that Cory Booker introduced into the Senate. And this would phase out large-scale factory farming by 2040. And you'll hear more about factory farming when my guest, John Eichert, comes on in a little bit. But factory farming is definitely not a good way to produce food. It's been really highlighted a lot in the news recently as the meatpacking industry is a petri dish for the COVID-19 spread of the virus. And it's just not the way that animals should be raised. It's not the way animals should be slaughtered. It's not the way animals should be packed up. We really need to just rethink our whole food system, and we'll be talking about that more. But again, I'm really so thrilled to know that Elizabeth Warren and Cory Booker are putting forward this Farm System Reform Act. 2040 still seems like a far way off. I wish it would happen even quicker, but either way, it's a wonderful thing. So I want to share this miso vegetable chowder recipe with you. As I said, I used wakame in this recipe, and then I also cooked up some ramen noodles. I used ramen noodles that were miso and brown rice ramen noodles, so they were gluten-free for anyone that does have a gluten allergy. Also, when you're purchasing miso, if you do have a gluten allergy, you want to make sure you're purchasing miso that is barley-free. Some miso is made from barley, so you need to just check the ingredients if you do have a gluten allergy. So the ingredients for this miso vegetable chowder, you're going to start with 12 cups of water in a large stock pot, 6 cloves of garlic. Feel free to put in 10 if you like a lot of garlic. Plus, you want a teaspoon of minced garlic on the side for cooking up some shiitake mushrooms at the end. 1 2-3-inch piece of ginger, and again, I also double that a lot. You can easily put in, you know, 3-inch pieces of ginger. You know, make it really strong on the ginger flavor too. Ginger has so many medicinal qualities, and so if you're feeling run down, you know, throw in some extra ginger. A cake of soft tofu. You can use firm if you prefer, but the soft is really custardy and delicious in this soup. Make sure that the tofu you purchase is organic, since soybeans are genetically modified if they're not organic. 1 organic onion and 2 organic carrots. 2 parsnips peeled and diced. 2 cups of organic broccoli florets. 1 cup of napa cabbage and 1 cup of bok choy. 8-ounce package of shiitake mushrooms. The stems removed, and we're going to thinly slice those. 2 tablespoons of olive oil, 1 tablespoon of tamari, 1 tablespoon of sherry wine, 2 tablespoons of wakame that we're going to soak in 1 cup of boiling water to reconstitute it. You'll just see how that wakame blows up. 4-5 tablespoons of white miso and 4-5 tablespoons of red miso, and then 1 8-ounce package of ramen noodles. And you're going to cook those according to the directions al dente. And when you buy ramen noodles, they come in these little blocks. And you basically need a block per person if this is your main course soup. Half a block is fine if this is just an appetizer and you're having more food after that. So you're going to fill a large stock pot with the water, bring that to a boil, and add the onions and the carrots and the parsnips, along with the garlic and ginger, and just let that boil When it comes to a boil, you can reduce the heat a little and just let that simmer for about 20 minutes. And while that's simmering, you're going to prep your other vegetables. You're going to cut the broccoli into florets. You're going to chop up the napa cabbage, and you're going to chop up the bok choy. And then you're also going to cube the tofu, whether you're using firm tofu or if you're using the soft tofu. You have to be really careful with that. I actually used silken tofu yesterday in the recipe, and it really was so fragile. So it will fall apart a little bit. So just, you know, add it at the very end because you just need it to get hot. Then the wakame, you're going to put the 2 tablespoons into a measuring cup and then add water, boiling water, to cover that up. And you'll just see how that will expand. Then you're going to add the broccoli, the napa cabbage, the bok choy to the soup after the onions and the carrots have cooked for a while. While that's simmering, in another heavy cast iron pan, you're going to saute up the shiitake mushrooms. So you're going to cover the bottom of the frying pan with a little olive oil. You're going to add a teaspoon of the garlic, and when that starts getting hot, add the shiitake mushrooms. You can also add some minced ginger to the mushrooms as well, if you have that. And just continue stirring the shiitake mushrooms. You want to let them really get cooked well done so that they're kind of golden brown on each side. Then you're going to add the sherry to the pan, and that will deglaze the pan, so any of the garlic or ginger that's sticking to the pan will just become removed immediately. And then you can also add the tamari. And continue cooking until those shiitake mushrooms crispen up. And those you're going to use as a garnish on top of the soup. So now we're going to remove a cup of the broth from the soup pot and put that into a separate bowl. And you're going to put the miso into that bowl, and you're going to mix that up. You can either use an immersion blender or just a spoon, the back of a wooden spoon, and stir that up really well so you're dissolving the miso in this cup of broth. And then you can either add the miso broth back into the soup pot, or you can just add the miso individually into each cup. And that's what I did yesterday in the demonstration. I actually took my soup bowls, I put a little bit of the ramen noodles in, then I put some of the concentrated miso broth, and then I did ladles of the soup right on top of the noodles. Garnished it with some fresh cilantro, the crispy mushrooms. I had a little gamazio on the side, and I also had some shishim tokarashi, which is a Japanese spice that has a spicy pepper in it, but it also has some orange peel, and it's just a delicious condiment for on top of the soup. And that's it. It's so delicious. You can adjust how salty you want the broth depending on how much miso you put in. And I use 2 different kinds of miso, like I said, the white miso and the red miso. If you prefer, you know, the mellow white miso over the red miso, you can just use one or the other. And that is it. It was so delicious. It cooked up really fast, and it's just a delightful dish. Like I said, anytime you're feeling run down and you just need a boost, you know, this is my go-to dinner. So enjoy that. If you do make the soup, I love feedback. So send me some comments at bhavani@ieatgreen.com, and I will answer you back. And now it's my pleasure to introduce to you all John Eichard. He is a professor emeritus of agriculture economics at the University of Missouri in Columbia. And as I mentioned, I invited him to come on to talk about the current pandemic and his take on how it is impacting our food system. And his experience and expertise in agriculture economics makes him a perfect person to share his perspective on how to feed everyone without being dependent on factory farms. John was raised on a small dairy farm in southwest Missouri. He received his bachelor's and master's and PhD in agricultural economics from the University of Missouri. And he worked in private industry for a time and spent 30 years in various professional positions at North Carolina State University, Oklahoma State University, the University of Georgia, and, of course, the University of Missouri, where he retired back in 2000. Since retiring, he has not been resting. He's been spending lots of time writing and speaking on issues related to sustainability, with an emphasis on economics and agriculture. And he's written 6 books, and you can find those on his website at johneichard.com. In 2014, he was actually commissioned by the United Nations, by the Food and Agricultural Organization, to write a regional report on family farms of North America in recognition of the International Year of the Family Farming. And he currently lives in Iowa, and it's my pleasure to invite him on. John, are you with me?
Yes, I'm with you. Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity to be with you, and your miso soup sounds very interesting. I may have to try that.
Oh, you definitely should. It's just delicious, delicious. So during this pandemic, you've really been writing quite a bit about the pandemic and our food system, and unlike so many people focusing on the problems, you're actually looking at some of the opportunities that this pandemic is highlighting. And I thought maybe you could share with us, some of the problems that you see, and then what you see as some of these opportunities, because we've all been reading about, you know, the farmers pouring milk into the lagoons and plowing under their crops of onions, and it's just painful to think of all the hungry people that are being impacted by losing their jobs and needing food, and yet all this food is just getting wasted. So maybe we can start by talking about the problems and some of the opportunities we see.
Yes, I think the pandemic has just simply revealed problems that have been in the food system for some time. And the problems are associated with the fact of what I call the industrialization of the food system. And that's specialization, specialize in doing fewer things so you can do them better, but specialize in specific things, specialize, then standardize, routinize, mechanize. And then when you specialize and standardize, you simplified the management process so that you can consolidate operations into large-scale operations, industrial operations. Those are basically the characteristics. And that's been going on in agriculture and in the food system for at least the last 50 years. Most people aren't aware of it. You know, they go to the grocery store, and if there's plenty of food there to buy, then they assume everything's okay. But this has been a problem all along. But now with this pandemic, we see the consequences of concentrating all of the production in large specialized operations. And what we're seeing breaking down now is the processing sector. We've got a few large companies that control practically all of the different processing sectors for pork and beef and poultry and fruits and vegetables and various other things. And they process these products in these large scale, like we hear all the talk about the large scale pork and beef processing plants. There's a pork processing plant, for example, one of them that closed down was killing 20,000 hogs a day, 20,000 a day going through that operation. So whenever the pandemic come in and the disease was so contagious, which they didn't anticipate, even if you had 5% of the workforce that come down with the coronavirus, then they had to close the plant because it was so contagious. Well, you close like a processing plant that's depending on processing 20,000 hogs a day. And then you've got that locked in with a system where you've got producers under contract with large confinement animal feeding operations, or CAFOs, where they're producing thousands of hogs that have to go to market to go into those processing plants. Then when that processing plant's closed down, you can't stop those hogs from growing. They're in the feedlots and they're growing and they're scheduled to go to market day after day after day through that processing plant. When that closes down, then that shuts the whole system down. And then on the other end, you've got the processing specialized in certain products that go to restaurants and certain products that go to the institutional trade, to the schools and hospitals and places like that, and others that go into the supermarkets. And so when you leave the supermarkets open, you close the restaurants and you close the institutions, then they don't have the flexibility to shift from one to the other. So you've got a surplus in one place and you've got a scarcity in the other. And so that's the reason we had, you know, surpluses at the farm level, and you had hogs and chickens and eggs and everything else coming out of production. and the processing plants being closed, and you can't get the product through the system to the supermarkets because the whole system is set up in this highly specialized way. So that's the system that we've created, and we created it for the economic efficiency, but what we basically ignored is that those industrial systems may be very efficient, but they're also very vulnerable. They're very vulnerable to disruption. They lack resilience. They lack adaptability. They can't adjust to changing situations. And so basically what we've done is we depend upon the government to bail everything out, and that's what we're doing now. But I mean, that's the problems that's been there for decades. And me and a lot of other people have been writing about this as well as I have. The problems have been there for decades, and the coronavirus just revealed it. And I think where it creates opportunities is I've concluded over the years that people don't make really big changes. And that's what we really need to make in the food system. And unless they feel and understand that what we're doing now isn't working and it isn't going to work. And that's what I think is being revealed. And I think that creates an opportunity for fundamental change in the food system. And we can certainly talk about those changes as well.
A question I have, and I'm sure many listeners are wondering, you know, when you talk about breaking the chain that's working, you know, like a well-oiled machine, you know, why can't the hogs just hang out a little bit longer? You know, I mean, you know, they're not going to just die by living a week longer or a month longer. They have, right. you know, a lifespan. Why can't they just live longer until the operation gets back up and running?
Well, what we're talking about in terms of particularly animals like hogs and chickens and beef cattle, that what we process, what we slaughter, you know, I like to call it what it is. I worked with a meat processing plant and we slaughter animals. What we slaughter in terms of animals are basically like teenagers. And if you know how fast teenagers grow, that's what's going on in these feedlots all around the country. And that's the way these animals are going. And they're in these confinement operations that are totally full. You know, they keep them operating at capacity because of efficiency as well. So let's say that you have hogs in a CAFO operation that are 160, 170 pounds. And I mean, 260, 270 pounds, and they got to go to market at 280 or so. So they're gaining 2 or 3 pounds a day at that point, and they're putting on that weight that fast. Now, the facilities are designed for those hogs to go to market at, let's say, 280 pounds. And so if they're going to 290, 300, whatever, they're exploding those facilities. There's no room for them. And then in addition to that, you may have the pits that are under the barns or the loons are designed for a certain number of hogs and a certain size of hogs. And so those begin to overflow. I talked to a contract grower one time that had gotten into a disagreement with the contracting operation that he was producing for, and he was producing feeder pigs. And in his case, because he was having this dispute with him, they simply didn't come and pick up the hogs. And so they didn't come and pick them up, and they continued to grow, and his manure disposal facilities just overflowed. And he had a major problem there. So you run into animal welfare problems because the facilities are totally full and they're overcrowded, and they're crowded to begin with. And when the hogs reach market weight, there's no more room for them to expand. You run into problems handling the manure, handling the waste from hogs that are that size. And you've got other hogs that are scheduled to go into those facilities because you've got the sow operation that has the feeder pigs, and the feeder pigs are coming from somewhere else and they have no place to go. And then they're running into problems. So, you know, a live animal system or a crop system, as far as that goes, you heard about them plowing under crops out in California, and those were destined, I'm sure, for the restaurant market. And you can't stop those things from growing. You can slow them down by not feeding them as much, but they're in a point where they're growing and they're going to continue to grow regardless. And that's the reason you run into the problems with them. And then also you run into problems because I read in one case where they had euthanized a whole flock of hens that were laying eggs, and there was a shortage of eggs in the supermarket. But those particular eggs, they were headed for the institutional market. They were going to be turned into liquid eggs and then frozen and sent out to institutions. And they didn't have the facilities on site to handle the eggs in a way that they could have been put into the, you know, the shell egg market. And so in that case, they come in and euthanize the birds because they were going to keep laying eggs regardless, and there was no place to go with the eggs. So that's the problem that's built into this system. Whereas prior to that, when I worked with a large meatpacking company back in the 1960s, Wilson Foods. Wilson was the fourth largest meatpacker in the country at that particular time. But back at that time, there were a large number of smaller operations. There were larger numbers of packers. There were a larger. I was in Missouri at that time, and we had the Missouri Meat Packers Association, and we'd have annual meetings. There'd be 125, 150 people attend that annual meeting that ran packing plants all over Missouri. There's not two or three large commercial plants left, and a few locker plants is all that's left there. But when you have a large number of the smaller firms, and rather than having product under contract, you're basically selling hogs at each level. You'd have feeder pig sales that we'd have, and you had market hogs. We had terminal markets. We had auctions markets. So whenever one particular plant would shut down, it wasn't a massive number of animals that was going through it. And there were other plants that could handle the capacity of that plant, and you could go into the market and sell your hogs, take your hogs to the market, and then whoever needed hogs could bid on the hogs, and if one plant closed, there'd still be many packers that'd be bidding on the hogs. And the same way with the feeder pigs, there'd be different feeders that would be bidding on the feeder pigs. And you had a much more flexible kind of system. You had a very adaptable system where you could deal with the disturbances that are inevitable a part of agriculture. And that's where we need to go from here, and that's where I think we can go from here. Is if we recognize the problems, then we begin to move. There's a whole local food movement that's been going on for decades where we've had, you know, just an explosion in farmers markets and CSAs and roadside stands and other things. And it's remained a fairly small portion, in fact, a very small portion of the total amount of product or foods that's going through the system. But we have the people out here that are creating the alternatives that we need to move toward the future. And those systems, because of the size and the flexibility and the diversity and the individual markets that the product is going through, have the resilience to withstand these shocks. You're going to have these shocks in agriculture. That's just the nature of it, whether they come from weather or disease or hurricanes or floods or whatever. And we need a resilient system. And that needs to be a more localized system where when you have a problem in California or Florida in the citrus industry, or you have a problem in, you know, fruits and vegetables, things like that, the whole California fruit or vegetable operations is vulnerable to the very same thing. So when you have a problem in one area, there'll always be, if you've got production scattered out across the country and you got it decentralized, then you have the ability to cope with these disruptions that we're seeing that the current system is simply incapable of doing.
Right. But it sounds like our current food system is so huge. How do you, you know, how do you break up these huge monopolies and CAFOs and monocrop systems and have them diversify and have them get smaller? I mean, how would one even start to do that?
I think you work on two fronts, and you mentioned before the bill by Senators Booker and Warren and others that are supporting it to, you know, move away from the CAFO system over time. There's also a number of the presidential candidates this year that came out openly and said that we have too much concentration of economic power in the food system, and we need to break up these large corporations. And so on the one front, we need to continue to work on policy changes, but, you know, that may take a while, and the policy is only going to change when the public perception changes and when the public sees that there's an alternative. So I think where people can really get involved and make something happen is to begin to transform these systems at the local level and begin to take the initiative. I propose that we explore the possibility of creating community food utilities where we use the concept of a public utility, which is used for sewer service and water and electricity. When I was growing up, we didn't have running water. We didn't have electricity. But they came in with the rural electric cooperatives, which were public utilities that were operated by the people within the local community. And they brought, you know, what we call light lines, the light poles. They run the lines down the roads to the little farms like places where I lived. And so everybody had electricity because we had a public utility that says the private sector isn't going to do it because it wasn't profitable to run those lines down those roads to just a few customers that would, you know, about the only thing we had back then were light bulbs and maybe an electric refrigerator. It didn't make any economic sense to do that, but we did that because it was necessary, you know, to bring public utility, to bring electrical service to people. And now you have rural electric, rural water cooperatives and rural water utilities. And we have public utilities in the cities for public transportation and sewer and things of that nature. And so the food system is broken. And I think you could start by saying that even though we've talked about economic efficiency and reducing the cost of production, we have more people in this country that are food insecure today than we had back in the 1960s. We, you know, this figure is going to go even higher, but prior to the pandemic outbreak, we had about 11% of the people in the country that were classified as food insecure, and about 14%, about one in seven of our children in food insecure homes. We could establish local public utilities and say, you know, this is necessary to provide food security. And then we could provide that food to the people that are qualified for government food assistance and have the government food assistance go through these public utilities. And then the public utility could purchase the food, good food produced by local farmers. That's nutritious food, organic, sustainably produced, regenerative agricultural systems. We could begin to put in place modest scale processing facilities that would serve these local public utilities. And so, you know, we've got to start thinking about how we create different systems, and we can't just depend upon the market. We know now, I can tell you as an economist, the markets are simply going to do things that are, or the corporations are simply going to do things through the market that are profitable for them, the most profitable. And what they're doing now is the most profitable, as long as we taxpayers continue to bail them out when they have a problem. And so we need to end communities and then start changing your food system. I think now, and I've written about now, is the time to begin to really develop online sales and home deliveries. I think that's the future of retailing, and I think it's the future of food retailing. And if we have local systems where we're producing locally, and we can get that food, bypass the processing distribution systems there, get that food to people in their homes if they want to, or pick up points or through boxes or whatever, and we can bypass this whole industrial system a community at a time, and then we can link those communities together, and then ultimately you change the whole system. You know, I tell people one of the advantages of being old, and I just turned 80 back in December, is that I can remember when things weren't like they are today. We didn't have an industrial food system when I was young. We didn't have supermarkets. We didn't have chain restaurants. We didn't have any of the things that you associate with the food system that we have today. Most, I'd say probably 80-90% of what we ate came within 50 miles of the where I lived. We had local processors, meat processors. We had local flour mills, you know, local bakeries and all sorts of things within our community there. And the point is the changes in that food system from those local food systems where most of the product was produced very close to home, processed very close to home and things of that nature. That whole transformation took place in a period of about 40 to 50 years. And it took place whenever there were new technologies that came along, but that there were also changes in government policies, particularly in the 1970s, that moved us in that direction. But if we take advantage of the technologies that are there today to bypass the industrial food system at local level, community, community, community at a time, and that's the way we industrialized the food system. That's the way it happened, one farmer, one consumer at a time. So if we take advantage of the opportunity now to create a fundamentally different system that has the resilience and the regenerative capacity and the resourcefulness and the adaptability to deal with situations like the coronavirus and other disruptions that are happening, and that really meet the needs of people at the local level for healthy, nutritious food. And we can start by making sure that those people at low income levels get the very best food. And this, like with public transportation, where we have a public transportation utility, we build it because there's some people within the community that can't afford, you know, transportation. They don't have cars or various other things. But once it's built, then anybody can ride the train. Anybody can ride the bus. So we could do the same thing from the food system. It's just that other people would pay the full cost, and those that are food insecure then would be receiving the government benefits that we're paying now that really aren't meeting their basic needs, because they're, you know, maybe getting enough calories, but they're not getting enough nutrition. We have an epidemic of obesity and heart disease and diabetes and high blood pressure and a whole range of cancers. And that part of the system's broken too. So let's fix the system as a whole. I'm not saying this is the magic solution. I'm just giving it as an example of how we need to think about recreating the whole system rather than just tinkering around the edges. And we need to work on policy changes, but at the same time, we need to create successful examples of what we want to change to and what we want our policies to support.
Yeah, well, you just said it all. I mean, I've been hearing, you know, CSAs, which are community supported agriculture memberships, are like sold out. I mean, people are, you know, are trying to find resources, and there just isn't even enough of them. I mean, you know, it's just taken off. You know, I was listening to NPR talking about the milkman is coming back, you know, home deliveries of milk. Right. You know, when I was little, we had the little milk thing outside the front door, and our milk and eggs got delivered, and, you know, and he, you know, that's sold out, you know, and so I think the public would like to go back, but, you know, unless, you know, the whole, like you said, the whole system from the ground up has to change. And, you know, that's just a tremendous thing. It took over 40 years, you said, to get this way. Yep. How is the government going to start by turning it back? I mean, you know, these big corporations that have all this power and do all this lobbying. I mean, I know, you know, when the Obama administration was cutting back on French fries, I mean, who would even think that there's a whole French fry lobbying group or a whole pizza the frozen pizza lobbying group? You know, they went berserk when they were cutting back on French fries and pizza in the school system because that was hitting their bottom line. These corporations have so much power. Where do you suggest we start?
Well, I think we start at the local level, and that's where I think it has to be done. That's where I think things are happening, what you see right now. You mentioned the examples of the CSAs, and anybody that already had an online sales option, every place I hear is they've just selling all that they can produce that's online. And I think we need to see that as an opportunity to shift. And I think that we can do that at the local level. I have a friend over in Indiana, Greg Gunther Farms, but it's a sizable operation. He markets about 50 hogs a week, and he raises them all outside under humane conditions. He has sows faring every week of the year, and those are go through the processing plant. He also has chickens and turkeys. He produces about 1 million pounds of meat overall, the chickens and turkeys and hogs, about 1 million pounds a year overall. So it's not really a small operation, but much of his, probably most of his product was going to the high-end restaurants, particularly in Chicago and various other places, you know, where they wanted the humane raised product that are raised outside, raised under, you know, organic condition. He's certified organic and things of that nature. But when the restaurants closed, then it made a real shock on his business. But he was prepared, and I just saw he had posted on Facebook that he's 100% retail now. So he made that whole shift over from, you know, being in the institution restaurant business, shifting over to that. So he's basically all retail, all online, going through food buying clubs, going through CSAs, various other places that he's talked about. So there's the system that's placed. And one point I wanted to make is what I'm talking about is not going back to the way things were when I was a kid, but taking the opportunity to move forward to this new era of food distribution and retailing that I think is going to be increasingly about, we're going to be ordering our groceries online. You can do it on the telephone, but I think we're going to do it online week by week. And it's going to be assembled somewhere, and it's going to be brought, mostly it's going to be brought to our home. And I think that's the way retailing is going in general, and that's the way food retailing. And I think that's where we need to start looking at the future. And the important thing about that is that when you get around to the fresh food products, like we're talking about here, meat, milk, eggs, vegetables, fruits, things of that nature, I'm convinced that it could be more economically efficient to do that on a local level than it is to try to do it on the larger scale, such as Blue Apron, Home Chef. Those people are trying to source product all over the country and deliver it all over the country, and it's not working out very well for them. And so I think those are the kind of innovations then. And so when you begin to create examples of these local food systems that are working, then you begin to create public demand to change the laws, to change the regulations. You know, we talked about, you mentioned CAFOs and factory farms. People are opposed to CAFOs in general. Anybody that knows anything about them are opposed to them. But so many people say, well, what's the alternative? What can we do instead of that? And I think what it takes to shift public opinion and shift public policy, I mean, shift public policy, is you have to shift public opinion. And what it takes to shift public opinion, you have to have demonstrations. You have to have models. You have to have people that are doing something different. And then you can say what our government policies should do is not support this and support this other thing that we see out here. But as long as we're kind of just asking for policy changes to change to something and nobody knows quite what it is, and you can't point to specific examples of where it's working. And so I think what people need to do and what we can do, whatever every one of us can do, we can do whatever we can do within our local community to begin to change the systems there. And as we change the communities one by one, then we'll begin to get to the point where we can change farm policies. I mean, food policies and farm policies. But we can change our communities now. And if we use something like a public utility, we can insulate our communities from that global marketplace and from that corporate food system. You can't isolate it. You can't separate it from it entirely. But you can insulate yourself from it so that you're not just totally sucked into it every time you try to do something different.
Yeah. I was saying the laws also have to change, because I know I've heard farmers out on Long Island where I live in New York, there's no mobile processing units for processing animals, you know, and that, you know, in order to sell meat, you know, that has been killed, it has to be through a health approved facility. And they don't give licenses to facilities that are small and can meet the local level.
It is possible to get those. My friend Greg Ganthrop, he has a small processing facility, and I know several other people that do, but it's not easy. But one thing I wanted to point out in relation to that, you mentioned mobile meat processing. There's been several of them around, and I've been involved in some projects there. But I think you said, what can we do? One thing farmers are going to have to do if they're going to operate on a smaller scale, they're going to have to be willing to work together. Because if you want a small-scale processing plant, whether it's mobile or whatever it is, that processing plant has to process every week, every day of the year to have any economic efficiency at all, which means that the producers in a particular area, they have to get together and they have to agree so that they can time their product so that it goes through that. And if you're going to serve a local market of consumers, then you've got to have the production coordinated to the point where you've got product that are going to those consumers, like running a CSA. So if you want to scale up to the point where we can really begin to transform the systems at the local level, it's going to require farmers working together, and it's going to require consumers working together. And I've said on many occasions, I think the biggest challenge to agricultural sustainability, which is what I talk about, the biggest challenge in transforming the food system, transforming farming, is the challenge of human relationships, of getting farmers to work together, getting consumers to work together, getting people to recognize that they need to come together in their communities and start making changes there.
Well, I think I've been seeing that. I mean, I think the young new farmers that are embracing regenerative agriculture and permaculture and sustainability and organic, these young farmers are much more open to working together and cooperatively and sharing ideas. I don't get the sense, you know, I'm on the board of NOFA in New York, which is the Northeast Organic Farming Association. And, you know, we have our winter conferences and the farmers come together and people are sharing knowledge. People are sharing what works and what doesn't work and learning from each other's mistakes and saving each other from going down the wrong path. And I see a lot of cooperation happening. Have you seen that? And do you feel like that is a new phenomenon? Is it more competitive where you're seeing it, or what's your take on that?
No, I agree with you 100%. The conferences that I go to, the last conference, big conference I spoke at was the Upper Midwest Organic. It's called the Moses Conference now in La Crosse, Wisconsin. They had about 3,000 people there. And you see a lot more young people, young families and so on. And I agree with you. They are willing. They're totally different than the traditional farmers that I worked with back in the early days of my academic career as a livestock marketing specialist, ag economist, you know, very traditional farmers that I worked with then, very independent. It's almost impossible to get them to work together. But I think these young people out here, and one reason I keep doing what I'm doing, you know, people ask me if I'm optimistic about change, and I tell them, no, I'm not particularly optimistic. I don't underestimate all the obstacles we've talked about here in terms of policy and technology and everything else. They're out there, and the change isn't going to be easy, and it may not come really quick. But I tell them that I'm hopeful, and hope just simply means that you know something good is possible. And the thing that makes me hopeful is what I see in these young farmers, particularly the young people that are out here that are either in farming, they want to get into farming, they're willing to work together, they're willing to share information, they're willing to share ideas, and people that have been in it for, you know, 15, 20, 30 years in the organic farmers or permaculture, holistic management, they're more than willing to work with these young people. It's a whole different way of thinking about farming. It's a whole different worldview that's reflected among these young people. And when I talk about a transformation in the food system, if I didn't know that there were these groups of people like you talk about out here all across the country, I spoke at EcoFarm Conference in California a year or so ago, and I've spoken at NOFA of New York and NOFA of New Jersey and places like that. And there's the energy there, there's the excitement there, there's this willingness to work together, there's this hopefulness for the future. And all I'm talking about is trying to encourage changes in the food system in general that will make it easier for these people to succeed. But I'm convinced that if a young person gets involved in this operation, if they really think that farming is why they're put here on this earth, that you can find a way to make it happen. And you can find a way, I believe, to create these local food systems. It's just tremendously difficult. And it would be so much easier if we had accommodating government regulations and public policies and other things that would support the transformation of the system rather than supporting the entrenchment of the industrial system that we have today. But I'm convinced that people can find a way to make it work and to find a way to change the system, even in the face of all of this adversity. And that's the reason I stay hopeful. And that's the reason I continue to do, write, and speak and share my ideas wherever I can out of the hopefulness that somebody's going to pick up something and I'm going to make some small contribution to the transformation that will help make this world a better place.
Uh-huh. You know, it's so interesting listening to you talk now because you have really grown and changed in your opinion as you've gotten older, right? When you first started, you actually thought the industrial food system could be proved to be successful. The model that, you know, is working right now or not working right now, I should say.
Right.
Have really changed with the times. What brought that change for you? What did you see that really made the difference for you to realize that what was happening wasn't working?
Well, as you say, I started out in my academic career. I was a livestock marketing specialist, agricultural economist. I was one of these people that thought what we were going to do is help make agriculture more efficient. It'd bring down the cost of production, bring down the cost of food. It was going to make good food affordable to everybody. And in the process of having these innovations that reduce the cost of production, we'd create profit opportunities for family farmers out here, and we'd have prosperous, innovative family farmers. It'd be strong, viable rural communities, and that's what it was all about. That's what drove me to be involved in this. But, you know, to make a really long story short, but during the farm financial crisis of the 1980s, and crises, as I said before, are kind of common in agriculture, but this was a big one there. Because we were teaching this farm fence row to fence row and get bigger, get out, and, you know, the farm has to be a business farm for the economic bottom line, things like that during the 1970s. And the farmers that followed our advice, you know, were getting big rather than getting out. They were driving a lot of the other people out of agriculture, but they were getting big and they were successful, but they borrowed a lot of money at record high interest rates in order to expand their operations for buildings, equipment, land, or whatever. And then we got into the 1980s, and then we got into a domestic recession, a global recession, export markets dried up, and these farmers were caught with huge debts at high interest rates. Again, the lack of resilience, the vulnerability of the system to disruption. And those farmers were losing their farms. They couldn't even make the interest payments on those loans. And we had foreclosures and bankruptcies on the evening news almost every night. And farmers were committing suicide, like some of the dairy farmers have been doing in Wisconsin and other places over the last few years. And I looked around and I said, look, there's something fundamentally wrong with this system. It's not good for farmers. You know, the farmers are going broke, and these farmers that are doing what we so-called experts were telling them to do. And right. The rural communities were withering and dying because it takes families, farm families, and the farm families were leaving because they were going broke. And then it was only then I began to see what we were doing to the land in terms of erosion and pollution, the air, the water with agricultural chemicals and biological waste. And I didn't discover until later that we weren't even feeding the hungry, that we were just producing products for profit, or not for people. If you have any doubt about that, we've been burning up.
They come about with good intentions, but then you have to step back and look, did it work or didn't it? And when it doesn't work, you need to pull back and readjust. And I think one of the beautiful things with the young farmers is because they are going direct to market, they actually are getting paid a fair wage for their product. They're not being chiseled down to get the lowest price to go to market. And I mean, one of those things that we constantly were hearing about were there's no job that I think is harder than farming. I mean, you know, that's why we have these immigrants doing the work, because no one wants to do the work, because it's back-breaking hard work. And so these farmers need to be paid a fair wage and be able to make a decent living doing what they love and what they feel like their calling is. And that's one of the things that I see as beautiful with the young farmers, is that they are finding the way to make a living at it. They're using innovative practices. They're using direct market to retail, so they're not cutting out the middle person. And, you know, a lot of the farmers that I know, you know, they're not rich, but they're certainly making a decent living and something that they can really feel proud about, and that people who are getting their products can feel proud about the food they're eating, you know, and feel nourished by the food they're eating. So it's, you know, it's definitely, like you said, I'm hopeful. I'm hopeful, but we have a lot of work to do.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think, you know, the young people are discovering what we should all discover, that life isn't just about making money. You know, that's just supposed to be a means to something else. If you don't know what you want to do with your life, you'll never know if you have enough money. I mean, you'll never have enough because you don't know how much you need. So if you can create a good life, if what you want to do is farm and you can create a good life on the farm and you need to make enough money, you know, to go with a good life, it doesn't have to be a means of getting rich. And I think that's one of the biggest obstacles that we have to overcome, is this idea that, you know, that the economy and economic efficiency has to take priority over everything else. Whenever an obsession with that idea that all it's about is accumulating, making money and accumulating wealth, that all that's about is leading to a society that's probably as miserable as any society's ever been, mentally, if not physically, because we're not a very well society either, as we're learning from the pandemic crisis. But anyway, I think the idea is we need to come around and say, okay, what is it we're here for? What why am I here? What's going to make my life good? What can I do that will make a good life for me? And then set about trying to find a way to make that work economically, rather than starting off saying, well, how can I make the most money? How can I get the most income? How can I accumulate the most wealth? Start saying, what is it that I want to do? What do I feel that I was put here to do with my life? What's my purpose? What's going to give meaning to my life? What's going to give me satisfaction? And then say, how am I going to make that work economically? How am I going to meet my basic needs so that I can do what I really feel that I need to do with my life? And I think that's what the young farmers that we're both talking about here are doing. They say, I feel that that's what I need to do. And if I can make enough money on the farm, and as you say, the key is to connect with customers that appreciate what you're doing and want to buy the products that you're doing and will pay you a price that's high enough that it will allow you to live the life you want to live. And if you succeed in doing that, you're as wealthy, or you're as successful and even more successful than the person that has $1 million but still don't think they have enough. If you can live the life that you want to live and you can make enough money to do that, there's no greater success. And I think that's what keeps me hopeful, is I think we have a new generation, younger generation of people today that begin to understand this.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, you write about sustainability, and I think you're touching on it, that sustainability is not just
Absolutely.
About mental sustainability. It's about sustainability, in a much bigger essence. Sustainability, right. You know, not just for your own environment, but your health, your mental state, your ability to support yourself. I mean, sustainability, you know, is an umbrella term very often that, you know, that people sometimes use just in relation to environmental, but
right.
Much bigger than that.
Right. Very much so. I think sustainability, what's important about that, and it's been so misused and abused that I think people do it intentionally. They don't want to deal with it. It basically asks the question, can we continue doing what we've been doing indefinitely? And I think is it sustainable? That's basically what that says. Can we continue doing this same thing that we've been doing, going in the same direction? I think when you ask that question, honestly, looking at all the information, the scientific data, your common sense, everything else, it says, no, we can't. I can't tell you how much longer we can keep doing it, but we can't keep doing this indefinitely. Sooner or later, this food system is going to collapse. If we don't fix it, if we don't transform it, it will collapse. It's not sustainable, and we will have a food pandemic. We will have a food scarcity and starvation all across the country and around the world. If we don't do something to fix this system, it is not sustainable. It cannot last, and it won't last. And what we need to be doing is creating an alternative food system before that collapse that can last, that is sustainable, that's regenerative, that's resilient, that's resourceful, that can go on being productive and useful to human society indefinitely, so that people can have good, nutritious food so they can fulfill their purpose in life. And that's got to work economically, it's got to work ecologically, it's got to work socially. That's what sustainability is about.
Yeah, right. So, John, I want to thank you. We're just about out of time. You want to share with everyone how they can find your books and your website?
Y'all just go to johneikerd.com, johneikerd.com. And on that, my personal website, you'll find a link to my University of Missouri website. It's a more complicated URL, but you can click on that link. And I've got a number of blog pieces and papers on my personal website. I've got hundreds of papers on my university website from presentations that I've written and various other things. So you can find my books and find my papers and anything that's on my website. People can feel free to use it and distribute it and copy it or do whatever they want to with it. I just want to share my ideas as broadly as I can, and I really appreciate the opportunity to share my ideas this morning with the listeners on your program.
Thank you so much, Don. It's been so great. And I will share all of your contact info on my website as well. So those of you that are with us,